This is my zine. I like a porch. A house is not complete without one. Front or back is okay. Both is better. All the way around is the ultimate. A porch is a part of a building that is outside the building. Is this impossible? Good. The best thing you can do there is simply sit. Watch the world go by. Cogitate. You can do lots of things that aren't allowed inside. You can whittle and let the wood chips fall on the floor. No cleanup necessary. You can break a pine cone apart, piece by piece. Fart without remorse. Spill your iced tea and watch it run down the slightly sloping gray floor and under the railing. A porch makes even the smallest house look more substantial. By the way, leave decks out of this. A deck is an addition, a wing, a separate room with a floor but no walls or ceiling. It juts out there, not knowing what it is connected to or why. A porch, on the other hand, is an outline, a completing statement for the building as a whole. The roof overhangs it. The railing comes up to here, and the posts connect the two. There is a definite feeling of enclosure, though you are outdoors. A happy paradox. It's a transition area where you can do different things, as opposed to a doorway, which is a transition line that can only be crossed. The porch railing sets the stylistic tone for the whole house. A row of simple vertical boards, a series of carved posts, crossed diagonals, a solid low wall finished with the same shingles as the rest of the house. How about screens to keep out the skeeters? Or would you rather slap at the no-see-ums all evening? Smart folks know that the bugs aren't bad if you leave the porch light off. Come to think of it, dear, would you turn the lights off inside, too? No one's inside, anyways. Dogs love porches. They can sleep, but if an important noise or smell comes out through the screen door, they can look inside to check it out. If someone comes up toward the house, they know it early enough to run right out and meet them, and there is no door in the way. On the hottest summer days, dogs like to lie in the cool sand under the porch. Those whose porches go around the side or back know they are ideal places for Tonka trucks, boots, ironing boards, even table saws. But the best thing on a front porch is a rocking chair. A swing for two is good, of course. Don't forget that the top rail of a properly built porch is strong enough to sit on, too, though it is more often leaned on with just part of one's weight, while in conversation with someone in a chair. Some people, usually between the ages of 15 and 35, find it comfortable to perch on the top rail with their back to a corner post. They'll read a good book like that, or pretend to. More likely, though, they are pretending not to notice members of the opposite sex who pass by, or pretending not to be stirred by the warm breeze rustling through the trees. I worked on the railroad. Most of my time I was a fireman. Now, you may know that with the diesel engines that they have now, firemen are not really required. A fireman is an engineer in training, really. So what does a fireman do? This poem, by Anonymous, is called My Job. It's not my place to run the train, the whistle I can't blow. It's not my place to say how far the train's allowed to go. It's not my place to shoot off steam, nor even clang the bell. But let the damn thing jump the track and see who catches hell. During my freshman year in college, 1970-71, someone showed a short anti-war documentary on campus. I've forgotten everything except one scene. The film was either stolen out of the Army's files or was some soldier's home movie. The part I remember took place in a field of luxuriant high grass with forest, jungle in the background. It was a beautiful sunny day, blue sky. A Vietnamese man, presumably Viet Cong, was lying in the grass on his side, curled up in the fetal position. Three American soldiers were kicking him in the balls, really hard. All the males in the room squirmed in their seats. Such heroes. I wish I could get a copy of that film now so I could show it to draft-age boys and let them know what soldiers really do. Once when I was in the third grade, I was standing in the cafeteria line. The line actually went out into the hall, so no talking was allowed. I was a good boy, so I didn't talk, but I always had a habit of smiling for no apparent reason. Miss Lohman, who I thought was nice, saw me smiling. She walked right over to me, pinched my earlobe real tight, and pulled me across the hall with it. It hurt a lot. Why did she do that? Here's a piece by a man named Ernie Pyle, P-Y-L-E. Ernie Pyle was a traveling journalist during the Great Depression. He worked for a newspaper chain. His columns were syndicated. And he just rode around the country in his Model T and wrote about what he saw and who he met. Ernie visits Portland, Oregon. Do you know what Portland is? It's paradise on earth. At least, that's what people in Portland said. Personally, I never thought so, and I'll tell you why. In 1926, I came through Portland wearing overalls and driving a Model T Ford, with a tent and blanket roll tied onto the fender. A young man seeing America. I stopped at a roadside stand in the suburbs to eat some watermelon, and I was eating along, minding my business, when up came an old codger and started bawling me out. He gave me a long lecture and wound up by yelling that if I didn't stop smoking cigarettes and eating watermelon on Sunday, I would undoubtedly land in hell. I'd never had any use for Portland after that. Of course, the incident was on my mind as we drew near Portland this time. But I said, no, let's be fair. We'll start all over again with Portland and see what happens. About that instant, we came around a bend, and there staring us in the face was an expensive signboard, as big as the side of a house, saying in huge letters, "All hath sinned." That's all it said. Now, I don't know whether all hath sinned or not. But supposing all hath, why put up a signboard about it? After that, it took my friends 5 days to convince me that I was wrong about Portland. And incidentally, I stumbled onto a fine formula for getting treated like a visiting lion. Just say to somebody, "Describe to me the character of Portland, will you, so I can write a piece about it. You know, its personality. Its spirit. How they went to bat. People started giving me parties so I could hear about the spirit of Portland. They'd run to the phone and say, "Come right over, quick." And on your way, be thinking up how to describe the spirit of Portland. It was marvelous. I went to 5 parties and 2 luncheons and to 2 dinners in one evening. And another evening, we went to dinner and forgot to eat. All because people were trying to get across to me the spirit of Portland. Maybe that's it, right there. Well, anyway, here's what I put together out of all the scramble. Everybody in Portland is crazy about Portland. They rave about it. They don't talk like Chamber of Commerce folders. They don't talk about their industries and their schools and their crops. They roar about what a wonderful place Portland is, just to live in, and people do live well in Portland. That whole Northwest country is beautiful, and the climate is gentle, and existence is pleasant. Portland is a place, they told me, where money doesn't get you anywhere. They meant socially, I guess, so I tried to find out what would get you anywhere. What was the standard for social admittance in Portland? Definitely, they said, it wasn't money. And definitely, too, it wasn't blue blood. What is it, then? I asked. Intelligence? They hadn't thought about what it might be. So, they thought. No, it wasn't intelligence. Some of the social elite were both as poor and as stupid as myself. They thought and thought. They finally decided that was merely an ability to contribute something, usually agreeableness and interest. Portland is, on the whole, a conservative place. It is a city of homes, a place to raise your children. It was settled originally by Downeasters who came around the Horn. They made the money and became the backbone, and they kept on being the backbone. But somehow, they mixed their New England soundness with a capacity for living the freer, milder, Northwest way, and it made a pretty high-class combination. As for the physical appearance of the city, the downtown section is neither unattractive nor distinctive. The nice thing about Portland is that it rises into hills, and they're the most livable hills you ever saw. Thousands of people live up there, in fine houses, among trees, looking hundreds of feet down into the city. All about Portland there are small rivers and green fir trees, and not far away are the mountains themselves. A friend of mine, searching for the reason he loved the Northwest, finally decided that the sense of having everywhere around him these clear, cold, tumbling streams had a great deal to do with it. That was by Ernie Pyle, written in the 1930s, and it was republished in a book called Ernie's America. Nighttime at the Zoo. Ed is getting fed up with his therapist. Actually, he never felt comfortable with Roger in the first place. Not that he usually judges others by what they wear, but whenever Roger puts that torn paper sack over his head, well, it's hard to open up to a guy like that. Of course, it's perfectly normal for an orangutan to put a sack over his head. Maybe it's just the cultural difference. Well, these are the days of interspecies understanding, so Ed has decided to bear with it for now. Ed is a mallard duck. He sees Roger every week because he can't deal with the taunts he gets from the peacocks, the herons, and the Canada geese. They all razz him on account of his parents having had him Gore-Texed when he was a duckling. Even the mute swans try to push him underwater, for laughs. Everyone knows it's not his doing. His parents saw that he was having trouble staying afloat and keeping warm. They only wanted to help. Until now, he thought he didn't blame them for his unhappiness. But Roger has uncovered a lot of suppressed issues, like the fact that his mother didn't feed him for a week when he got sick. Now, that is normal in the wild, where parents have to support the strongest of the brood and let the weak ones go. Survival of the fittest, you know. But young waterfowl often take this as rejection. And his father flew south that first winter, something he had never done before. He sent back word that he felt hemmed in by marriage and just had to follow his instincts. Ed's mother called it abandonment, plain and simple. But who is she to judge others? This is a duck who lets herself be mounted by anything that quacks. Ed knows he has an identity crisis. He knows his father's departure wasn't his doing, but he feels guilty anyway. He knows his mother's sexuality shouldn't reflect on him, but it does. He detests her, but he can't help loving her. Does he love his mother too much? Uh-oh, an Oedipus complex. Does he identify with her too much? Maybe he's gay. It's not easy being a duck. Jomo is also getting help, but for him, it's been very positive. He goes to the group session that the lemurs co-facilitate every Monday night. When he first heard about it, he couldn't understand how there could be any focus. Group therapy is like a three-ring circus anyway, what with so many animals wanting to talk. And the way the lemurs bound around their enclosure like so many rubber balls. They all look identical, too. How could anyone keep track? One thing about Jomo's kind, every leopard has a unique spot pattern. When Jomo arrived at his first session, though, all his doubts melted away in a minute. The lemur's sameness is their asset. Their bodies are interchangeable, yes, but their minds are, too. They all think, speak, and act at exactly the same speed, in perfect sync. One says, "Did that experience teach you something about responsibility?" and bounds away. Just as quickly, another drops into the center of the circle and asks, "Are you using what you learned with your own offspring?" 1, 2, 3, bang, bang, bang. Everyone comes away from it inspired, feeling good about themselves. The chimps don't see anyone. It is obvious that they already have their heads together. They are socially successful because they address their problems immediately and directly, using expressive body language and chatter that pulls no punches. In other words, they let off steam as soon as it begins to build. In a few minutes, everything is fine again. In addition, they have developed social grooming into an art form. Picking mites out of your cage mate's fur is as sure a bonding mechanism as was ever invented. The male elephants think they should run the whole zoo, just because they are the biggest and have the most space. But no one pays them any mind, and each one is so self-directed that no two of them can ever get together to dominate anyone else. Who ever heard of chomping off the last 2 inches of your own brother's trunk? Males are such animals. The female elephants are quite another story. Their supportiveness is legendary throughout the animal kingdom. They actually invented midwifery. It's no wonder they help each other out, though. Can you imagine giving birth to an elephant? And that's after being pregnant for 22 months. Under such circumstances, it's no wonder Cecily is going through this depression. Losing a 2-day-old baby is a horrible thing. So she is seeing Carmen, the tarantula from Paraguay, a therapist's therapist. "Carmen, really, what good is it? All we do is eat, shit, and die. Plus, we females have the curse of heat, and then families to raise. And those poor things have no future. I just don't get any fulfillment from life. And now that I think about it, I never have." "So what's fulfillment? You have it pretty good here, don't you? Would you rather be back in Thailand, hauling logs?" "No, of course not. Have I told you that my older sister stampeded and crushed her owner? They shot her, of course. She was a martyr, I tell you. But look at us here. We're a spectacle, the object of laughter. If we didn't bring in the crowds, they would have let the poachers finish us off years ago. Why are you using the human's value system to judge your worth? Let's work on your self-esteem." "Oh, Carmen, I'm just an elephant in a zoo." "I know you, dear. You wouldn't be here if you didn't think more of yourself than that. Let's make a list, starting with what it means to be an elephant." "Oh, all right." "You're bigger than anything else. You can run 20 miles an hour. With your reach, food is virtually unlimited." "So what? That may be useful in the wild, but I'm stuck in this prison for the rest of my life, eating Purina elephant chow and peanuts." "I hate peanuts. Goddess, what's wrong with me?" "You're not the first elephant to dislike peanuts." "We like rubber tree leaves. Why won't they give us some? Humans have a weird sense of taste, that's for sure. All the more reason to disregard them.
But we have to regard them. Face reality, Carmen. They do have us fenced in here, and they accomplish that by using their superior brains.
You know that's not true. Everyone knows that humans are the least intelligent species.
I guess so, but they do have us in here.
Come on, girl. You make it sound like animals can't adapt.
Sometimes I feel like I can't. You can take just so much habitat destruction.
I hear you, dear.
What do you know about it? You can always find a few square feet of undergrowth to call home. But a herd of elephants needs many square miles to get along. You know, I wouldn't have thought the humans capable, as puny as they are, but now it looks like they really will destroy the world. They are wiping out a species every day, and they are so deep into denial that they believe it's a good thing. They actually boast about agriculture.
Listen to you. You are sounding like a human on a guilt trip instead of a pachyderm at the top of her food chain. Do you really identify with them?
Well, I don't want to, but they've controlled my whole career. The year in the circus was the worst.
Let's talk about that some more. Last time, we were able to determine that you didn't grow to dislike it. You disliked it right from the start.
That's right.
Did you ever feel physically sick? I mean, other than from the food?
Well, I always got sick on the circus train.
Very important. Try to remember your first train ride.
How could I forget? I was just 2 1/2. My master took my mother, my little brother, and me to the station in Bangkok. All of a sudden, my brother and I were in wooden crates and being loaded into a boxcar. I can still hear my mother trumpeting frantically.
Did you realize what was happening?
No. Not even my mother knew. We didn't even have a chance to say goodbye.
Where is your brother now?
I don't know. After some hours on that train, we were both taken off and put on other trains. I never heard from him again. Poor kid.
Did you ride trains much in the circus?
Oh, yes. At least once a week, we'd ride all night, or even longer.
And you always got sick?
Always.
Does it happen to other elephants?
Not really. You know, we have very good balance.
Yes. Isn't it true that the swaying elephants do when standing in place is actually an exercise to strengthen your equilibrium?
Yes.
Did you make friends in the circus?
Well, sort of. There were 2 other little elephants, but they were African, and I'm Asian. They're from the savannas, you know.
What about the adults?
The females acted like male elephants. I mean, it was like they had a chip on their shoulders. Lots of the animals in the circus are like that.
Did you understand why? I mean, did you understand back then?
No, I was just a kid. I see what you're getting at, that I missed my mother.
Okay, sure I did. You felt secure with her.
Of course. Elephant mothers are the greatest.
I want you to think about that, and about losing the baby. Don't try to draw any conclusions. Just keep track of all the thoughts that come to mind, okay?
Okay.
See you next week.
That was Nighttime at the Zoo. I thought of it after I got an after-hours tour at the Oregon Zoo from a friend who was working there. Once years ago, the Oregonian sports section featured some quotations from the previous week in their Sunday edition. And one week, there were 4 of them, and I thought they were all great. So I'm going to read them to you. They put sports in its place in our society, and they gave me a chuckle. And you'll need to note that Leo Durocher, who was named here, was a baseball player and manager, and was known as Leo the Lip. First, Tom Treblehorn, on being dismissed as manager of the Milwaukee Brewers, said, "I feel like a guy in an open casket at his own funeral. Everyone walks by and says what a good guy you were. But it doesn't do you any good. You're still dead." University of Houston wide receiver Torin Polk had this comment on his coach, John Jenkins. "He treats us like men. He lets us wear earrings." Leo DeRocher, quoted talking to the president of NBC when called over to his table in a restaurant, "I don't table hop. I don't eat with drunken bums. And as far as I'm concerned, you should be eating out of a trough." And Eugene McCarthy, the 1968 presidential candidate. "Being in politics is like being a football coach. You have to be smart enough to know the game and stupid enough to think it's important." I'm going to tell you how to start and stop a freight train. This is a skill you are not likely to ever need, but it might be enlightening. So here goes. First, understand that there is a tremendous amount of weight involved. It would be hard to get all that moving at once, though not impossible with today's powerful diesel locomotives. The way it's done is, in effect, to start one car at a time. The engine pulls the first car pulls the second pulls the third, and so on. Why doesn't the last car start moving as soon as the engine does? Because of a designed-in feature called slack. Slack is your friend. Between any two cars, there is about 6 inches of slack, 1 inch between the couplers and 5 inches behind the couplers in big springs. So the engineer applies a little power, the first car gives a springy yank to the second, and so on through the train. So it should all start gradually and smoothly. But be careful. Just give it enough power to keep the engine moving, and add a minimum of additional power as weight is added, until the whole thing is moving and it is all stretched out. If you accelerate too suddenly, you can do real damage. Here's how. Let's say your train has 100 cars, each of which is 50 feet long. You should start up at a creep, I mean about 6 inches per second. And don't speed up. With 100 cars, you have about 50 feet of slack to take up before the last car gets the message. If you start right up, one of three things will happen. One, a particular heavy car won't budge and the coupler will snap. Two, some freight will get damaged in the boxcars. Or three, which is no longer the case, your colleagues on the caboose will literally have the rug pulled out from under them and will be disappointed in you. Most of these men belong to the National Rifle Association, so it's a good idea to give them a smooth ride. I wrote this piece quite a while ago, and of course, cabooses are no longer used. Okay, now you're rolling along at 50, waving at the kids, and feeling generally important. How do you stop the damn thing? If you apply the engine brakes, the slack will run together. Remember, those guys on the caboose are still paying attention. Also, if you applied the brakes on only the engine, you would either burn off the brake pads or slide the wheels flat. All that weight is now pushing you onward. Fortunately, you have another friend. This one is called the air brake. Thanks to the air brake, you have brakes on every car in the train. Now you can get the train under control. There is an air hose that runs through every car. As you operate the control on the engine, the cars respond to two things: how much air pressure you have in the hose, and how fast or slowly you change the pressure. So you can just slow down for a curve, or hold back your speed on a downhill, or you can stop. But remember the slack. Any change in air pressure will only travel through the train at about 500 feet per second, so that the engines could be slowing down for 10 seconds
before the caboose hears about it. Crunch! Here's what you do. Keep the engine brakes released and keep pulling as the car brakes take hold. The effect is to stretch the train, and the train drags itself to a stop. If you are stopping too short, add some power. If you're not stopping short enough, reduce power. Once the train is stretched out, you can adjust all you want to without doing harm. Normally, you start about 2 miles ahead to stop a 100-car train going 50 miles per hour. By the way, if you suddenly put on the brakes fully and cut the power on such a train, you would still go at least half a mile before stopping. Stopping a train at a precise spot takes a lot of practice. Good luck! More about trains. How big is a train? Where I worked, 90 to 100 cars was about average. A typical boxcar is 50 feet long, but some are shorter and some are longer. Both the flat cars that carry truck trailers and the cars that carry automobiles are 89 feet 3 inches, which seems to be the maximum. The longest train I was ever on was made up mostly of these auto racks. We had 167 cars and totaled 2.6 miles. How long is that? If the caboose was at Food Front on Northwest Thurman Street, and the cars went all the way up 23rd to Burnside, then all the way down Burnside, past Powell's, through Old Town, all the way across the bridge, across MLK and Grand, the engines would be in front of the KABU studio on Southeast 8th. The heaviest trains are those that carry coal or grain. Each car carries 100 to 120 tons. Many of the trains through the Columbia Gorge are grain trains. 100 of these cars would weigh 12,000 tons or more. Sorry, I just don't know what to compare that to. Maximum speed for freight trains varies. They are not limited by power or curves so much as they are by stopping distance. So grain and coal trains typically are 40 miles per hour, general mixed types of cars 50 or 60, and piggyback trains 70. These last ones are lighter than others, even though a 100-car piggyback train carries the equivalent of 200 trucks. We're talking big numbers here. Passenger trains are a different story. In this country, some stretches between New York and Washington are done at 130 miles per hour, but most Amtrak routes are between 60 and 80 miles per hour. The fastest train I ever ran was also my first. It was my last day of being fireman for an old-timer known as Gunsmoke Pixley. I am not making this up. After working with him for 2 weeks, he gave me a chance to runner and said, keep it between 75 and 80. The speed limit was 70. I did what he told me and wore a silly smile the whole time. A couple of days earlier, Gunsmoke had called me over to his side of the cab. He pointed to the speedometer. 88. He was wearing a silly smile that time. One time our lead engine caught fire. He had three of them coupled together, and the other two were pulling us along, so he pointed me toward the fire extinguisher, opened up the throttle a little further, and kept right on going. What the passengers didn't know never hurt them. Have you ever wondered how seemingly unrelated things get together? I'm thinking particularly of stores. Why do some newsstands specialize in tobacco? I sold books to a bookstore in Wyoming that was half Radio Shack. People who didn't know Walter Powell may wonder why his bookstore sells Ukrainian egg decorating supplies. Does this make you think of a store, maybe in your hometown, that combines two unrelated things? Here's a very short item that was in the Oregonian some years ago. Headline, Katz's premier open house draws diverse people,
needs. Portland Mayor Vera Katz's first open house drew about 20 people eager to get a personal hearing with the mayor on a variety of subjects. Officer Sheridan Grippen said one man only wanted to have his photograph taken with Katz. Grippen, who shot the photos, said the man warned Katz, "I've got to tell you, I'm schizophrenic." According to Grippen, an unfazed Katz inquired, "Are you taking your meds?" "I'm taking my meds," the man replied as he left happily. Laughter by M.A.C. Farrant. How many laughers make up a laugh track? How are laugh tracks engineered? Is there a laugh track company with its own building, parking lot, cafeteria, paying corporate taxes? Does the laugh track company have its own stable of laughers and highly trained technicians? Are laugh track companies union shops with shop stewards and an annual general meeting with negotiated contracts covering such items as sick leave for laryngitis and with the right to strike for better working conditions? Do laughers laugh at anything? At nothing? Is the mark of a good laugher one who can laugh for no reason at all, as if a switch were turned on? Do laughers practice laughing, sitting or standing in their living rooms, kitchens, bedrooms, or on public transportation systems? Do they suddenly ring out with laughter, practicing the same laugh over and over until they get it right? Do professional laughers, therefore, have to carry identification on their persons at all times, which will reassure startled or frightened passers-by that they are indeed just practicing their trade and not, in fact, mad or dangerous or both? Is there a pay scale for laughers? Are guffawers, hooters, roarers, and howlers paid more for their work than are gigglers, twitterers, cacklers, and snigglers? Do belly laughers and shriekers command the highest fees, enough to make a decent wage? Enough to claim in real life the equivalent of the humorous middle-class counterpart presented in many of the TV sitcoms they perform for? What is real life? Is it that state of being which exists other than what is presented on television and in movies and videos? Something other than performance and posture? Are there child laughers? And what of amateur laughers? Are there how-to-laugh books developed especially for them, which can be purchased at magazine shops, drugstores, and which encourage them to embrace laughing as a hobby? Are there night school courses that amateur laughers can attend in January, February, March? Tricks of the trade that they can learn from practitioners who are slightly more skilled at laughing than they are? Techniques such as breath control, crescendo, decrescendo, as in the training of singers and musicians? Are there laughing forms to master? And what of those sad, abnormal souls who stubbornly refuse all merriment, all lampshade, and all lewd joke activity? What of them? Should there not be places, institutions, homes, where they can receive treatment for their affliction, from which they can emerge, restored to rapture, and armed with their vials of nitrous oxide to declare that it's not better to sorrow than to laugh, it is not better to die than to be born? Is it true, then, that as we get older, euphoria declines and our capacity to have fun diminishes? Why is there no fool like an old fool, young fools being a dime a dozen? Is there a market, therefore, for personal, portable laugh tracks? Small, special recording devices that we can all carry around, attached to our persons, to enable us to laugh at our families, governments, worlds? Would illness, despair, hopelessness, anguish finally vanish, as some people have suggested?
Would we all then be prodded into states of chronically good moods, not tormented to death as we are now with the what fors and whys of an absurd existence? That was Laughter by M.A.C. Farrant.
If you're interested in language, as I am, but maybe not interested in sports, you might have missed a piece in the Oregonian about sports team names, sports mascots. This is by Mike Dara. It all began with the Bend Lava Bears, and like any good revelation, it just about knocked me over. There it was in bold print, the Bend Lava Bears. The epiphany proved indelible. A non-existent species of bear had been created by the simple addition of the word lava, and a wonderful high school nickname had been born. So began a strange and ongoing obsession with high school nicknames. As a 12-year-old fledgling sports fan, reading the game stories from the 1966 Class AAA Boys State Basketball Tournament, I was beset by a desire to learn all of Oregon's high school nicknames, and within a fairly brief time, I knew them all. I still have the dubious ability to name any mascot in the state, plus most in Washington and Idaho. Whereas most nicknames lean toward the tried and true ferocity of lions, panthers, and grizzlies, the nickname connoisseur is always seeking the descriptive, the humorous, the unique, and just plain odd. We want mascots to stand apart from one another and represent their communities in unique ways. This Friday, for example, the Toledo Boomers football team takes on the Tillamook Cheesemakers in a classic matchup of one-of-a-kind Oregon high school nicknames. The state's 280 high schools who field OSAA sports teams are divided into five major mascot categories: human images, 115, animal names, 103, bird or fowl, 35, snakes, insects, fish, meteorological phenomena, mythical beings, 23, no nickname whatsoever, 4. The mascot enthusiast must endure many respectable yet uninspiring nicknames before hitting pay dirt. The truly good mascot should mirror something of the school's local geography, economy, or history. A good mascot can offer a clever play on words, or it can be unrelated to anything but still be fun if it's highly unusual. Some of my favorite nicknames that exemplify a school's sense of identity are the Astoria Fishermen, Grant Union Prospectors, Klamath Union Pelicans, and Pendleton Buckaroos. These mascots all reveal something about the school's local economy, habitat, or history. Numerous others fit this category. The Grants Pass Cavemen. The Oregon Caves are a local tourist attraction. South Wasco County Redsides, a trout in the nearby Deschutes River. Powers Cruisers, a logging term. And Rainier Columbians readily come to mind. Most of the Portland Interscholastic League features very appropriate nicknames as well. The Grant Generals, Franklin Quakers, Roosevelt Rough Riders, Marshall Minutemen, Madison Senators, and Jefferson Democrats. Considering the pervasiveness of the lumber industry, it might be slightly surprising that only 5 high schools in the state go by loggers. And with Oregon's Old West and Lewis and Clark heritage, one might expect more than 4 schools with the Pioneers nickname. Only one high school, Beaverton, adopted the Beaver, and there are no Ducks. Southwest Washington has a number of inventive nicknames: the Ridgefield Spudders, Fort Vancouver Trappers, Camas Papermakers, R.A. Long Lumberjacks, and Kalama Chinooks deserve mention. Among those mascots that best typify cleverness, alliteration, or plays on words are the Pleasant Hill Billies, Gladstone Gladiators, Sherwood Bowmen, Seaside Seagulls, Warrington Warriors, Lakeview Honkers, Dayville
Devils, Griswold Grizzlies, Elkton Elks, and Pilot Rock Rockets. A few of these didn't require a lot of creativity, but at least an attempt was made to be different. Then there are those nicknames that are somewhat odd. The Weston McEwen Tiger Scots came about after two small Eastern Oregon schools merged in the 1970s, combining nicknames as well. The Tiger Scot doesn't make a lot of sense, but is one of a kind. The Bonanza Antlers is rather unique. While being the Elks might be one thing, it's interesting that the school chose to be known just by the antler. The Toledo Boomers might also seem a little strange at first, but once one learns that a boomer is a small animal native to the Coast Range, where Toledo is located, the name becomes very apt. Some of my favorite nicknames don't fit any of the above criteria, but are entertaining nonetheless. It's hard to deny the North Medford Black Tornado, Madras White Buffaloes, Central Lynn Cobras, Sisters Outlaws, Gresham Gophers, Chehalem Valley Academy Watchmen, and Adrian Antelopes, not to mention the Oregon Episcopal Aardvarks. Many mascots from earlier eras now are deemed politically incorrect. Most nicknames based on Native American terms or tribes are generally viewed as insensitive. The Enterprise Savages mascot has come under scrutiny and alteration, as has the prominent nose of the Amity Warrior. Oregon has no monopoly on questionable nicknames, however. A couple of other Northwest high schools always have had controversial nicknames. The Richland Washington Bombers, who formerly sported an atomic mushroom cloud on their football helmets, foster some discomfort. A website is devoted entirely to the Bomber mascot's history and the cloud of controversy. http://alumnisandstorm, that's all one word, .tripod.com/mascot. The Orofino Idaho Maniacs may be the most blatantly inappropriate of them all, at least to the casual visitor. On a driving trip to Wisconsin some years ago, I made a point of stopping in Orofino, a town that is home to a mental institution, to see how the high school's mascot was portrayed. The maniac looks like a small screaming child with electrified hair, as though its tiny fingers had just been inserted in a light socket. On a recent visit to Yuma, Arizona, I was surprised to encounter the Yuma High School Criminals. The mascot is pictured as a rather scary-looking fellow who probably spent too much time in solitary confinement. A tour of the old territorial prison in Yuma revealed that the high school was housed in an upper floor of the facility in the early part of the century, so the criminal's mascot is historically relevant in a sinister sort of way. The unfortunate flip side to the insensitive nickname is that newly opened schools tend to select very tepid and inoffensive nicknames to avert any controversy. I don't particularly dislike the Storm, Thunder, and Wildcats, but they aren't likely to inspire much special allegiance from a nickname aficionado. On the other hand, at least these schools made an effort, however ineffectual. Four of Oregon's 280 high schools rejected nicknames altogether, perhaps revealing a degree of ambivalence about being identified with any local flora and fauna. With traditional schools, a visit sometimes yields a more novel mascot depiction than might be implied in print. One wouldn't expect the Huntington Locomotive to have a menacing, snorting face on the front of the charging train, for instance, or the Oakland Ochre to be a little man with a hard hat, perhaps to deflect falling acorns. The Watonka Eagle is portrayed as a strutting bird with a puffed-out chest and scowl. It's worth returning to schools from time to time to see if they have updated their image. The Duffer Rangers in recent years have evolved from a slightly cartoonish forest ranger to a more macho, cowboyish one. In the course of the makeover, he seems to have misplaced his, perhaps less than politically correct, pistol. And while I'm primarily loyal to Oregon prep mascots, I've broadened my search over the years to include fascinating examples from around the country. my interest in high school nicknames turned at some point from the passive act of browsing newspapers for intriguing new names to traveling the state and country in search of fresh inspirations. Quite often, I have pulled into a town on a hunch the local high school nickname might be worth knowing. Rapid City, South Dakota Central is the Cobblers, although I didn't immediately notice any evidence of footwear factories in town. A stop in New Harmony, Indiana, revealed its nickname to be the Rappites. I learned the name derived from George Rapp, who tried unsuccessfully to establish a utopian commune in New Harmony in the early 1800s. The North Beach, Washington Hyacks is another singular nickname. School athletic director Bob Sutter provided the information that the mascot is a winged foot and the moniker is based on a Native American word for fleet of foot. While I look upon the Lions, Kansas Lions and Burroughs, California Burroughs with favor, my all-time favorite is the Mitchell, South Dakota Colonels, K-E-R-N-E-L-S, whose mascot features a flirty, winking ear of corn. To add to this grain theme, the high school games are broadcast on radio station KORN and played at the Corn Palace. I confess to spending the night in Mitchell solely for the purpose of buying a Colonel's sweatshirt the next morning at the sporting goods store. I also have traveling informants who are more than eager to share a fascinating new find. My friends Bill and Norma Moulton of Portland once called from West Virginia to inform me they'd passed the home of the POCA, P-O-C-A, POCA High School Dots. I hadn't the heart to tell them I already knew of the Dots and thanked them graciously. Another friend, Cal McDermott of the Dalles, called from Montana recently to alert me to the Bats of tiny Belfry High School. Among my other informant favorites are the Venice, California Gondoliers, Teutopolis, Illinois Wooden Shoes, Frankfort, Indiana Hot Dogs, Salem, Massachusetts Witches, Omaha Benson, that's in Nebraska, Omaha Benson Bunnies, Aspen, Colorado Skiers, and Blooming Prairie, Minnesota Awesome Blossoms. With the internet, it's all too easy to call up the High School Athletic Association for any given state and peruse the nicknames. But what's more fun about this peculiar hobby is the opportunity to travel to out-of-the-way places. There's always an unforeseen high school nickname yet to discover, which is enough to keep my interest from flagging and my car often on the road to places and nicknames as yet unknown. Go Awesome Blossoms! This piece was by Mike Dara, published in The Oregonian. Dara suggests also a few missed opportunities. Instead of the Lapine Hawks, it should have been the Lapine Cones. Instead of the Crow Oregon Cougars, why not the Crow Crows? Instead of the Spray Eagles, how about the Spray Atomizers? And instead of the Riddle Irish, what's wrong with the Riddle Puzzlers? And Dara also has a short piece about the team in Hollywood High School, Hollywood, California. What could possibly be the worst nickname for a high school's athletic team to have to bear these days? It comes from Hollywood, of course. The Sheiks, good grief, have been the symbol of Hollywood High since the late 1920s. The school logo is a guy wearing the traditional white head wrap flowing in the breeze with the words Sheik Territory underneath. It's no wonder the school's auditorium has been mistaken for a mosque by Muslims new to the area. According to a dictionary definition, a sheikh is an official in the Muslim religious organization. Some Americans might be a bit touchy these days about cheering for such a mascot, but not in Hollywood. There's been no reaction at all, Vice Principal Dick Rippey said. The nickname was adopted after a newspaper dubbed the Hollywood High football team the Men from Sheikdom, a reference to film idol Rudolph Valentino's role as the Sheik in 1920. Sheik was a popular name at the time. In baseball, the Hollywood Stars of the Pacific Coast League went by the Sheiks for a time in the 1930s. So did a team from Oakland in the California Hockey League of the late 20s and early 30s. The only time there's been a ripple of controversy about the name at Hollywood High, the alma mater of Lana Turner, Jason Robards Jr., and other actors, was in the late 60s, Rippey said. That's when a brand of condoms was marketed under the name. Long story short, there was talk of changing Hollywood High's nickname to the Stars. But Sheiks they remained, and lately they have not been awfully intimidating on the field. Going into this weekend, the football team had won only 2 games in 2+ seasons, none this year. This is being recorded in 2001. It's an unusual nickname, said Rippey, who coached the football team from 1974 to 1983 and won 3 East Valley League titles. We've talked about whether it should be changed. Some adults have brought it up. But I haven't heard a word. Honestly, I don't know if the students even make the connection. And that piece actually was by a different author, Tom Hoffarth, of the Los Angeles Daily News, and published in the Oregonian in 2001. Here's a case where local people decided to save their old-growth forest. This piece comes from High Country News, a biweekly Western environmental newspaper. It was published in August 1998. The residents of the Lake Tahoe Basin want their old-growth trees, dead or alive. A regulation that took effect last month all but prohibits the harvest of trees over 30 inches in diameter, whether they are on public or private land. Because it applies to both green and standing dead trees, the Tahoe Ordinance expands existing U.S. Forest Service regulations that bar felling green trees over 30 inches. Now even the Forest Service must get a local permit to log in the Tahoe Basin. The logging limits adopted by the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency are designed to promote and perpetuate the old-growth ponderosa forest that once graced the basin, said Steve Chilton, an agency planner. People came together and said these big old trees have value beyond their value on a logging truck. Tahoe's old-growth ordinance grew out of a local consensus group that has been discussing forest ecosystem issues since 1992. Members of the Forest Health Consensus Group were driven together by the specter of a dying forest that began haunting the Tahoe hillsides in the late 1980s. As many as 1 out of 3 trees turned rust-colored, the victims of bark beetles. Although most people recognize the fire danger posed by these standing dead trees, many opposed Forest Service proposals to log them. The ordinance permits the Forest Service to continue prescribed burns on 1,000 acres every fall, pruning the forest so trees have room to grow to large diameters. However, in other respects, the old-growth ordinance is a tree-by-tree management plan, since it allows the removal of hazardous trees with a permit, but acknowledges that old-growth trees are valuable to the forest even after they have died. Although that runs counter to the traditional Forest Service practice of salvaging every commercial saw log possible, the federal agency can live with it, said Joe Oden, a Forest Service planner with the Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit. Agency officials were part of the group that backed the new regulations. It's not as though we were planning to log a lot of big trees, Oden said. The first of its kind ordinance will be enforced by the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, an unusual body created by Congress and an agreement between California and Nevada. It may herald a growing national preference for tall trees over saw logs. As public values shift from forest products to forest experiences, recreation is replacing commercial logging as the primary activity on America's 155 national forests, said Jim Lyons, Undersecretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Forest Service Chief Michael Dombeck has clearly embraced the change with his focus on land stewardship and watershed restoration. Restoring the Tahoe Basin forest to its previous grandeur will take science, innovation, and time, said Jamie Ziegler, a Tahoe conservationist and active member of the Forest Health Consensus Group. This is a step, a huge step, but just a beginning, Ziegler said. The ordinance, which expires in 2 years, allows time to inventory and map each old-growth tree in the area. The ordinance has loopholes, said Jeff Cutler, assistant executive director of the League to Save Lake Tahoe. Whether they're big enough to drive a logging truck through depends largely on Chilton, the Tahoe agency planner, who will interpret the ordinance for landowners seeking permits to log. Again, that's from High Country News, August 3, 1998. Here's one more very brief but very good idea. A rooftop garden in Manhattan. Eli Zabar, owner of two restaurants / gourmet food shops, uses biointensive production methods on the rooftop of a building on the high-rent Upper East Side to raise specialty produce and sprouts sold in his stores. It's pointed out that grocery stores could raise some of their own produce on their unused roofs using organic waste from spoiled produce and from nearby restaurants for compost, as well as waste heat from their cooling equipment. The stores could lease out the rooftop or grow the produce themselves.